This week on the Best of Flashpoints, we hear from Eva Golinger and Graham Russell on the unraveling situation in Honduras and ousted President Zelaya's call for an insurrection against the coup government. Also, John Elmer reports from the Egyptian Seam Zone near the southern border of the Gaza Strip and documents the humanitarian crisis because of Israel's ongoing siege. And Barbara Lubin reports from inside Gaza as she accompanies George Galloway's Viva Palestina convoy to deliver humanitarian aid. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman with Dennis Bernstein. All this straight ahead on the Best of Flashpoints. Stay tuned.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. Deposed Honduran leader Manuel Zelaya has called for a popular insurrection in his country so he can be returned to power after soldiers removed him at gunpoint on June 28th. I am reading from Agence France-Presse. This just came in. He says, according to Agence France, quote, "The Honduran people have the right to insurrection." He said this Tuesday in Guatemala, and he went on to say, according to this article, insurrection is a legitimate democratic right when faced with a usurping government and a coup-supporting military. He said he is urging his supporters to strike, march, and engage in civil disobedience because, quote, there is a necessary process when the democratic order of a country is disrupted. And he went on to say, we're going to hear about this from Tegucigalpa, quote, "I want to tell you, the people, not to leave the streets. This is the only space that they have not taken from us." A little later on this broadcast, we will go to Tegucigalpa, but we are delighted to go back to Caracas, Venezuela, where we are again joined by Eva Golinger. She writes the blog Postcards from the Revolution, and she has been putting this together in terms of exactly the role that the U.S. government played in this coup. Eva Golinger, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Thank you very much. Good evening.
Good to have you with us. Why don't you, let's just go through this as fast as we can, but just give people a sense of the breadth of U.S. participation. And you lay it out on your blog if people want to go back and check out more, but let's go through this. Lay it out.
Certainly, yeah, and more evidence and information is coming out every day, and the pieces are coming together as things evolve further. But in any case, at this stage, we already know substantial, important information that definitely evidences Washington's role in the coup. And so as I see it, these are sort of the main issues. The prior knowledge of the coup that the Department of State had, this has been confirmed now during several State Department press briefings. There was reported on the New York Times. There were delegations, high-level, including Subsecretary of State Thomas Shannon, Assistant Secretary of State for Western Hemisphere Affairs, Craig Kelly, and several meetings on the ground between the U.S. Ambassador Hugo Jordans and those involved in plotting the coup. They have admitted, the U.S. Spokespeople have admitted that they tried to stop the coup from taking place by trying to find another solution. But as the evidence is beginning to show, as things unravel, that, you know, words may have been said, but not necessarily actions were portrayed that demonstrated and backed up those kinds of warnings. On top of that, and this is one of the major areas of the evidence, is precisely the actions, the funding that has been coming out of USAID and the National Endowment for Democracy and funneled through the International Republican Institute and the National Democratic Institute, which are two entities that were created by U.S. Congress, along with the National Endowment for Democracy in 1983 in order to funnel monies to political parties that promote U.S. agenda internationally, and particularly in Latin America is where these entities began to operate. And so what's been also evidenced is that those groups involved in the coup, civil society groups, media associations, even the Catholic Church, even the evangelicals in Honduras, have been receiving funding from USAID. And this funding was not cut off despite the warnings from the Department of State saying that they knew the coup was coming. They didn't threaten to suspend the funding, and they haven't suspended it since then. In fact, the monies have been dispersed for this year. So we're talking around $49 million of U.S. taxpayer money. That's a lot of money going into them. So they had prior knowledge of the coup. They funded the actors involved, the organizations, political parties, even the military. And they've been advising them as well. I mean, the money is not just the only factor in U.S. aid. It's also strategic advice and all kinds of communication support. Then we have the issue of the direct military role. You know, again, the U.S. has a large military presence in Honduras since the 1950s. It was accelerated and incremented in the 1980s with all the dirty wars led by Negroponte and the Reagan administration. But it still maintains a presence on the Sotocano Air Base, and it's around 600 U.S. forces, and they engage in all kinds of training programs and exchanges with the Honduran military. So we have a Honduran military that's executed a coup that's been schooled, commanded, funded, trained, and armed by the Pentagon and by the United States. And so, again, there's another issue. They weren't warned sufficiently beforehand if this warning is real. That would have induced them to not execute the coup. I mean, that they're funding and their arm source, and you know, this kind of relationship with the Pentagon will be cut off, and it hasn't been cut off. As a matter of fact, I mean, here's a piece of data. The State Department has said on several occasions that the military cooperation on the ground in Honduras has been temporarily suspended. But as folks are reporting back from Honduras, who've gone to the base themselves and checked out and interviewed the U.S. officers on the base, there are about 600 U.S. armed forces there. They have said that everything is normal. They haven't stopped or seized any kind of operations, even joint operations with the Honduran military. So we have that. Obviously, if the Honduran military was in any way pressured by the U.S. military that their arms supply would be cut off and all their funding would be cut off and their support, they certainly wouldn't have executed a coup. It would have meant their termination. Then we have the ambassador on the ground, Hugo Jordans, who's quite a character himself, U.S. ambassador. He's a Cuban-American, came over on Operation Peter Pan, which was like this major propaganda show put on by the CIA, saying that the communist government in Cuba was going to take people's children away, so they shipped them all off to Miami. And this ambassador, Hugo Jordans, is a product of that CIA operation. And he's been involved in several different covert ops during the past 20 or so years in his reign in CIA and State Department. He arrived last year in September and has been, it's again another known fact on the ground that he's been meeting with the those involved in the coup. And in fact, a month before the coup took place, or actually 3 weeks before the coup took place, the beginning of June, the U.S. ambassador made a statement to the press that any attempt to create a new constitution would be a violation of the Constitution. And he was referring directly to one of the reasons why this coup against President Zelaya took place, which was an opinion poll that was going to occur on the day of the coup on June 28th, asking the people of Honduras if they wanted to have constitutional reform in 2010. Then we have the...
Now, let me just jump. So we've got an anti-Castro Cuban CIA operations type as the U.S. ambassador to Tegucigalpa during the coup. Did he ever leave Honduras?
No, he's still on the ground.
He's still there, stayed there.
He's on the ground. He is still actively dialoguing with the coup regime, which is now the government, de facto government in Honduras. And Hugo Jordans also was, you know, a National Security Council advisor on Venezuela during the coup here in 2002. That's not a joke. I'm not making it up. I mean, it all sounds sometimes like some kind of fiction story, but it's real life. And on that point of the fact that the U.S. hasn't withdrawn its ambassador, here's the other major issue. That initially a lot of people didn't capt right away. They didn't get it right away. They thought Obama's condemning of the coup, Secretary of State Clinton's condemning and talking about the restoration of President Zelaya to power was a clear sign that the U.S. was against the coup. But nevertheless, and I've been very consistent in pointing this out from day one, the State Department particularly has been very clear, one, in not classifying the events of the coup d'etat, so they don't have to suspend any cooperation aid, military, economic to Honduras. And two, that they've always been talking from the beginning about two parties involved. So they've been legitimatizing from the beginning those involved, those executing the coup, and they've been trying to place responsibility and blame on President Zelaya for his ouster. And now we've seen that come full force with, you know, after now 2 weeks of this kind of ambiguous discourse from State Department, now we're seeing, you know, after the mediation efforts began in Costa Rica and the U.S. State Department refusing to further really make statements about what's going on and the fact that President Zelaya hasn't been restored to power. Coup government is consolidating its operations on the ground, including the mass repression of the people. And yesterday, when President Zelaya gave an ultimatum to the coup regime, saying that this Saturday is the next meeting that's alleged dialogue or negotiation in Costa Rica, he said an ultimatum saying, if on Saturday the coup regime doesn't step down, then, you know, and there, he will consider the mediation to have failed and will take another course of action, part of that being what you mentioned already, the insurrection of the people of Honduras against the regime. The Department of State's reaction to that ultimatum was to say, you know, they thought that they didn't agree with President Zelaya, that President Zelaya needs to be patient with the dialogue taking place and that things should work out through the mediation process. I mean, this is a clear sign now that Washington is not backing or urging for the unconditional immediate restoration of power of the constitutionally elected president, and they're pushing it back further and further as much as possible so that the regime consolidates. It becomes, you know, more and more credible to the international community as those high-level lobbyists, Clintonite lobbyists like Lanny Davis, are working their stuff in Washington and with the media, you know, to provide credibility to this coup regime. And it seems further and further likely that President Zelaya is going to be returned to power. And while all this is going on, you know, we've still got this flow and this relationship coming out of Washington. No substantial steps have been taken whatsoever to pressure the coup regime. No economic blockade, no cutoff of military aid or economic aid, no commercial blockade. I mean, it's, you know, and they're pushing it back, waiting out for the elections that are scheduled in November that were scheduled before presidential elections, hoping that if things, you know, are drawn out that long, Honduras will elect a new president and the whole thing will be over.
So this is bipartisan with the executive branch, in essence, working very closely with Congress to suppress this democracy. And what is the big gain for the U.S. in terms of the eyes of the Clinton State Department?
Well, I mean, the big gain here is U.S. interest in the region and trying to regain territory that has been lost to leftist movements like in Venezuela and Bolivia and Ecuador and, you know, somewhat Honduras. And the, more so the integration and, you know, the new trade agreements have been created in the region that exclude U.S. the U.S., United States exclude U.S. power and domination. And so we're talking about here, I mean, you know, it's the battle of the ideas. We've got an ideological situation going on. We have an economic situation going on. And we also have a huge power interest of U.S. empire wanting to reclaim their backyard. And the fact that during the past 10 years, there's been this tremendous shift to the left. And there have been all these initiatives that have been incredibly successful regionally of Latin American cooperation and integration, creating all kinds of new trade models that people in the United States couldn't even imagine, you know, foreign policy based on cooperation, solidarity, and mutual benefit instead of competition and exploitation, which is what U.S. foreign policy is. And so, you know, this has become a tremendous threat to U.S. power in this particular region. And now what's taking place here is being used as a model and as an example for other regions.
All right, let me jump in here. I'm sorry. Let me just jump in here, Eva, because we're running out of time. We're going to get a report live from Tegucigalpa, but I want to get a sense from you how this is playing in Caracas. We saw in Venezuela, we saw that Obama shook hands with Hugo Chavez and that there seemed to be some kind of new relationship and new openness. And we do see something happening in terms of the relationship to Cuba. But what's going on the ground? What's in people's minds? What's the word on the street there?
Well, I mean, people here in Venezuela, and especially during the past 10 years that we've had the revolution in Venezuela, are very skeptical of U.S. policy. Nevertheless, I mean, President Chavez has really reached out to President Obama and has tried to even change the image somewhat of the, at least the new White House here in Venezuela. We, you know, we've been used to 10 years of aggression and intervention during this time period. But nevertheless, I mean, people in Latin America have been used to, you know, centuries of U.S. imperialism. So it's no shocker. I mean, the difficulty here is sort of the separation of who is Barack Obama and the joy and sort of the hope that it's brought to many people in Latin America and around the world, because he's the first, you know, African-American president, had a discourse about change and equality in terms of foreign relations. But we're not seeing that play out. So, you know, rapidly, that whole discourse of Obama's, which personally I think was a marketing strategy, is being deconstructed by the administration themselves. And just yesterday, even, and the day before, a few speeches that President Chavez gave in different scenarios here in Venezuela, he called out to Obama and said, look, I mean, you made a promise about changing Latin America relations with the United States, that your administration would be different, and you're not doing that. And he said, take measures, take strong measures, like an economic blockade, some kind of pressure, withdraw your ambassador, and if you don't do it, you know, we're going to see that you're backing this coup. And I think that's generally how people are beginning to feel here in Venezuela, and it's very scary, because what we're seeing is that, is this going to be the Obama administration policy in Latin America? Are they going to permit coups and fund and support coup d'etats that install regimes favorable to U.S. interests? If so, we're just seeing, I don't know what the smart power of Hillary Clinton's is, but basically what we're seeing is the same exact policies from the past 50 years of the different administrations in the White House on Latin America. And so, you know, people here are getting used to the idea of that it's more of just the same.
We only have 60 seconds left, but what are you hearing, Eva, in terms of the repression? We heard about the assassination over the weekend. Spend 30 seconds updating what you're getting in terms of repression.
There is still, you know, a curfew in place, despite what they say to the media. And the streets of Honduras are still militarized, and they're still persecuting all those who are protesting the coup, including the media. The media, all the Venezuelan and Telesur media, were expelled from the country, so we no longer have people live reporting on the ground. And just beyond that, what's important here is to maintain the stamina, the willpower, and the determination, the morale of the Honduran people, because they're the ones in the end, and that's what's important about President Zelaya's call to insurrection, which is a constitutional right, actually, for them to maintain their presence in the streets and to increase it as much as possible with international solidarity and to defeat the coup regime.
All right. Eva Golinger writes a very important blog, Postcards from the Revolution from Caracas. She is the author of The Chavez Code, Cracking U.S. Intervention in Venezuela, and now she's cracking U.S. intervention once again in Honduras. Thank you so much for the great work, Eva.
Thank you very much.
And you are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. If you're just tuning in, I want to read you a little bit of what came off Agence France-Presse, and then we're going to go to Tegucigalpa. They are saying, they're reporting that the deposed president, Manuel Zelaya, is calling for a popular uprising. He's saying that it's time for the people to take the streets, and I'm quoting the story, "I want to tell you not to leave the streets. That is the only space that they have not taken from us." Let's go to Tegucigalpa, Honduras, where we are again joined by Graham Russell. He's with Rights Action. He's based in Honduras now. That group is based in Canada and the United States. It's a human rights action network, and Graham Russell has been involved in Honduras for many years. Graham, you were at protests this morning. Tell us about what happened at the protests, what the mood is on the ground. Things are building for tomorrow.
Yeah, they are. I think the mood on the ground is very empowered, but it's very nervous. As listeners may know, there was a huge weekend of protests on July 4th and July 5th. Hundreds of thousands were out we've already discussed on this program the shooting and the killings of a couple people that day by soldiers at the airport on July 5th, the wounding of others. Since July 5th, from the 6th through till today, there's been an ongoing series of protests that have been sort of shows of popular power, but picking one place on one day and another place on another day to keep the movement going, but also giving chance to what was the so-called dialogues in Costa Rica that have gone absolutely nowhere. And now the popular movement in Honduras has been building towards what they're calling two very significant days of protest tomorrow, which is Thursday and Friday. So on the streets today, the energy was increasing even more again. One of the things that happened today is that the coup government is trying to reshape all of the ministries. So they've appointed a woman, I don't have her name in front of me, to head up the Ministry of Women's Affairs in Honduras. And so the women's movement, as part of the pro-democracy movement, anti-coup movement, said, no, we will not accept this. So they've been protesting in front of the Ministry of Women's Affairs. It's not called that, but I don't have the exact name in front of me. That protest was broken up with violence today. And
broken up with violence? What do you mean? How was it broken up?
Well, rubber bullets were fired into the crowd. And I don't, that story will come out later. The full details of that story will come out later tonight. I joined the protest at the second part of the protest in front of the National Congress, where this is what I was told by people in the street, that they had come from the Institute of Women's Affairs, and that soldiers had opened up fire with rubber bullets. At the second protest, which was in front of the National Congress, there was a standoff between thousands of pro-democracy protesters and hundreds of heavily armed soldiers and police. But the main purpose today was to again keep the energy high, but also be announcing to people, and therefore to the whole country, that tomorrow morning, Thursday morning at 7 a.m., there will be significant protests on the main entrance to Tegucigalpa, both the southern entrance that goes down towards Nicaragua and El Salvador, and the northern entrance that heads north through Honduras to Guatemala. This is, I guess, an attempt on part of the pro-democracy movement as a huge show for us to choke off the main arteries of Tegucigalpa. As I understand it, there's going to be other efforts to sort of close down the other main city in the country, which is San Pedro de Sula, which is in the north.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Graham Russell. He's with Rights Action. That's a human rights group based in Canada and the United States. He's in Tegucigalpa, Honduras. He's been monitoring these growing protests. Now, where are you right now?
Well, I'm in the city of Tegucigalpa. There's been a curfew for the last couple of weeks since the coup. I have not heard whether there'll be a curfew today or not, but I'm staying with in the private home of a family that we've worked with for many years, right in the city of Tegucigalpa.
Okay, tell us about who's coming to the protests, what kinds of signs, what are people saying as you participate in these protests?
What people are saying, there's a lot of very creative, if not very outspoken, graffiti and signs. But again, this probably is oversimplifying things, but there's certainly three main sectors represented in the protests. One is the popular movement, loosely defined. These are campesino organizations, indigenous organizations, women's organizations, a variety of unions. These are folks that, some of them we've been working with for many years, that are sort of the grassroots movement that have been demanding reform and change to Honduras for years and years and years. And these are the poor sectors, as I said, many of them are campesino movements and indigenous movements. The second main sector that has a lot of force in the country is the teachers' unions. The teachers' unions in Guatemala are the strongest unions, they're not, and the biggest. And thus far, there's been close to 100% unanimity in the public sector teachers' unions, and so they're on strike. And when the teachers go on strike, it creates a huge force in the country. The third sector that's starting to really put out numbers of people in the street is actually the Liberal Party itself. It's actually the party of President Zelaya. It's actually the party of sort of the de facto coup leader, Robert Micheletti. But there's a break in his party, and it's coming from the youth wing of the party, but it's not insignificant. How it plays itself out in the future, I don't know. But for example, tomorrow morning, it is the Liberal Party itself that's mobilizing their base movement to go and take over the southern entrance to the city, and it's the popular movements that will be mobilizing their bases to block the northern entrance to the city.
We're going to watch it very closely, Graham Russell. We thank you for your time and the good information and your human rights activity. We're watching the situation closely here on Flashpoints, and you've been a great help. We hope we can continue our dialogue with you.
Thank you very much.
In Berkeley, I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We continue our focus on the deteriorating situation for Palestinians inside the occupied Gaza Strip. The Ma'an news agency is reporting that Palestinian bulldozers and construction vehicles have begun removing the rubble of the Saraya security compound in Gaza yesterday, more than 6 months after Israeli warplanes leveled it. The compound was destroyed by Israeli missiles on December 28, 2008, the second day of Israel's assault on Gaza. Project coordinators said that it would take multiple work crews up to 5 months to complete the rubble clearing projects across Gaza. It will take a month to clear the rubble from the Saraya compound alone, noting that many of the buildings around the site were also rendered unusable by the Israeli bombings. Earlier today, according to the Israeli newspaper Yedioth Ahronot, two Israeli military torpedo battleships crossed the Suez Canal from the Mediterranean Sea to the Red Sea. Several days ago, it was reported that an Israeli missile boat crossed the canal to the Red Sea to conduct, quote, operational activities. The nature of the operation remained highly secret, and the Israeli Navy has recently increased its activity in the Suez area in cooperation with the Egyptian authorities that oversee the canal. Meanwhile, the Viva Palestina U.S. convoy, organized by British MP George Galloway and Vietnam veteran Ron Kovic, says that in a statement on its website, it has been, quote, facing barrier after barrier in recent days, despite having initially hoped to cross into the Gaza Strip this morning. The Egyptian government, collaborator in Israel's severe blockade for the past 2 years, has set up a course of administrative obstacles which will delay the group's entry into Gaza, end quote. The convoy is set to bring 200 vehicles packed with medical and humanitarian supplies into Gaza. Joining us to talk about the current situation in the context of the Egyptian role in the ongoing and crushing siege on Gaza is our special correspondent, John Elmer. John is a Canadian freelance reporter and photojournalist. He writes for Interpress Service and has been featured in The Dominion and The New Statesman. He speaks to us now from Egypt. John, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Thanks for having me.
So it's good to have you back on the show. It's been a while. Let's talk about where you are right now and what you've been documenting over the last 2 weeks, especially around the role of the Egyptian government. You know, it's not as spotlighted when it comes to discussing who is helping enforce this two-year-old Israeli-imposed siege on the occupied Gaza Strip. Tell us about what's happening right where you are right now.
I'm in the North Sinai Desert, just south of the Gaza Strip, attempting to cross into Gaza to report and experiencing many of the obstacles that you described in your lead there. Egypt, although publicly says that it's in support of the Palestinians and that it would never blockade its brothers, as Mubarak has said, as you noted, has played a crucial role in the blockade. The border between the Gaza Strip and Egypt is really the Palestinians' only exit point, considering that Israel controls the sea, controls the airspace, and of course, Gaza being a ghetto is completely an enclave within the Israeli state, so there's no way of passing through any border besides with Egypt into the Palestinian territory. So in fact, in many ways, Egypt's blockade of the Gaza border, which happens, of course, in conjunction with the Israelis, is as devastating as the Israeli side. And it's important to note, of course, that the number one recipient of American aid is Israel, but attached to that, the number two recipient, give or take, is Egypt, and that goes back to the Camp David Accords, and effectively it's aid for the dictatorship of Mubarak, who regularly wins elections now. He won his sixth election in 2006 with really impressive numbers, 98-99% of the vote, you know, and has had a state of emergency in place parliamentary approved state of emergency in place since 1981. Effectively, that state of emergency is against the main grassroots opposition in Egypt, which is the Muslim Brotherhood, the umbrella political movement that gave birth to Hamas in the Palestinian territory. So, you know, the blockade from the Egyptian side is less discussed and is less openly talked about, largely because we don't get the savory quotes that the Israelis give us about the reasons for the blockade, but has been devastating for the Palestinians. And I'm in Al-Arish right now, which is the sort of largest city in the North Sinai, about 45 kilometers south of Gaza. And here in Arish, you have a situation where aid that cannot get into Gaza is left to rot in the main football stadium, the airport, at the seaport. You know, the blockade of humanitarian transfers from the Gaza Strip, of course, are visible on the streets all over Arish and all over the North Sinai, as Palestinians are able for various reasons to leave the Gaza Strip, but then not return, leave the Gaza Strip in many cases for necessary health treatments that are not available in the Gaza Strip. And so, you know, the border with Rafah, to quote Israeli numbers, previous to the Intifada in 2000, you had more than 1,000 Palestinians crossing each day into Egypt. Now, the blockade that Israel has imposed, although we often link it to the election of Hamas or more recently to the Hamas takeover in Gaza, of course, predates that significantly. And we've seen those numbers of people crossing the borders down to, according to Gisha, which is an Israeli legal human rights group, down to about 3% of what it was historically. And there's no official policy in place to oversee the Egyptian side of the blockade. So at least on the Israeli side, we know it's total. But on the Egyptian side, it's not spoken of and it's not acknowledged. And therefore, nobody understands when they can cross and when they cannot. And you get these amazing situations that I've witnessed here along the border in my the blockade has affected me as well as an internationally accredited journalist. I can't, I'm having difficulty getting in across the border. Hopefully that will change. But as it stands, I've gone a number of times to the border with what I thought was coordination to cross and found myself amongst the Palestinians who have been also blocked from going to the border and met, you know, really harrowing stories of people that are on the borders who, for example, one case of a man that I met who was, you know, these are uncounted casualties of Israel's blockade and of Israel's war on Gaza in December and January. You know, he was a diabetic. He is a diabetic, and insulin supplies were part of the blockade and weren't allowed into Gaza in sufficient numbers during the war. And so he lost his leg, as many and many others did, losing limbs to gangrene because of the lack of insulin. And so he's on the border with his prosthetic leg that he got in Egypt. He was granted permission to leave the Gaza Strip, but now can't get back home again, and literally sleeps night after night out in the desert underneath an awning of an empty shop right on the border, living on the largesse of, ironically and absurdly, the Egyptian border guards that are under orders not to allow people back in are giving him, you know, whatever is left of their lunch and whatnot, and that's what he's surviving on. You have, you know, 85% of or more people in Gaza dependent on food aid. So there's not a lot of what we would call savings or credit. And so when people are leaving to go to a place like Cairo, which is a six-hour journey away, they don't have the kind of resources to then stay in a hotel or whatnot until the border can be cleared up. You know, the kind of access and resources that I as a journalist have, talking to you from my hotel in Arish, he's still sleeping on the border again tonight for the second straight week. waiting for his access to cross back home again, to get back home again. So it's not, you know, something that's affecting international businessmen who want to go to Saudi Arabia to do an oil deal or whatnot. You're talking about the real salt of the earth. People are affected in the most fundamental ways. And when I first met him, his phone was ringing and his family was calling, you know, for the fifth time that day and for the hundredth time in the last 2 weeks to find out what he knows and when he's coming home. And the only answer he can ever give is, I don't know, maybe tomorrow. And that's the condition, you know, that's just one story, but, you know, I could tell you the story of the literally dozens. It's not known exact numbers because people blend back into the Egyptian landscape to wait if they do have resources, are renting apartments or staying with family. Many Palestinians here in Arish are in overcrowded apartments, you know, trying to share rent, having their rent paid by Palestinian authorities if they can, while they wait for coordination that that comes maybe once a month if they're lucky. So, you know, this is a really untold element of the blockade on Gaza and how it affects, you know, how the Egyptian regime itself has affected that that part of the blockade.
That's the voice of our special correspondent, John Elmer, speaking to us from the border area between Gaza and Egypt. And John, you know, you mentioned the humanitarian aid, the food that is being left to rot in football stadiums in Arish and the surrounding areas. If you can, detail the process for us a little more about what happens when these trucks, these convoys from the International Committee of the Red Cross or the United Nations or the World Food Program get to the border. What kind of bureaucratic deals are going on where it ends up that this food, these medicines are being left out to expire in the sun instead of reaching people who are there?
Well, in many cases through Egypt, what you have is you have other Arab neighbors or North African neighbors sending aid outside of these international organizations. And so, you know, because of what is not allowed in is the same on the Egyptian side as it is for the Israelis. And so when people, for example, you know, Libyan shipments or, you know, of course the war in Gaza in December and January created a situation where average people in countries all over the world, but of course particularly in this region, were giving and giving to try to help the circumstance. And so you had people sending these aid shipments, which are, if you know, if they have one thing on the banned list, and I don't know how much time we have to go into what's on the banned list, but it's so comprehensive that an entire truck shipment can be turned back because it has something like paper in it, or chocolate in it, or almonds in it. Something like this can turn back an entire shipment. And so this is the reality of the situation, and no one really knows what to do here in Arish or elsewhere about what to do with the aid, because, as we say, it just simply rots. In some cases, it's being given to, you know, impoverished people here in Arish, which is itself a very poor area. But if we can sort of get into some of the banned items on the Israeli list, which is, of course, the same as the Egyptian list, it would be shocking to listeners, you know, electronic, anything electronic, any appliances, refrigerators, washing machines, any kind of spare parts, car parts, fabrics, threads. Here I'm reading from the Office of the Coordination for Government Activities in the Territories. This is an official Israeli list of banned items. You know, includes light bulbs, candles, matches, books, musical instruments, crayons, clothing, shoes, mattresses, sheets, blankets, cutlery, crockery, cups, glasses. You know, and these kind of things, if any of these items, sesame seeds, chocolate, nuts, appear in any of these products or any of these shipments, then they're banned. And this is one of the things that the Viva Palestina George Galloway convoy is experiencing, in that they're attempting to bring in things that are not banned on the list, so as to bring anything at all. If you mix in your medical supplies with your almonds, they're not going to get in and, you know, get in. And you get ridiculous situations where shampoo is allowed but conditioner is not. And so you have an entire shipment of, you know, two-in-one shampoo that gets turned back because it has conditioner mixed in. And the level of detail, the meticulous level of detail that the Israeli government coordinating office has on these products is really shocking. This is not an accidental blockade or some sort of broad-based sanctions. You have it literally down to the caloric intake for each individual in the Gaza Strip divided by what is called humanitarian crisis levels. And this links back to what the key Israeli advisor, you know, if I could call him the Karl Rove to Sharon and Olmert and Tzipi Livni, Dove Weisglass, he called it when Hamas was elected, he called it the diet, that the people of Gaza were going to be put on a diet. You know, they were going to be put to the edge of starvation, but not starved to death. That was the goal, stated publicly, openly, front page of the New York Times, Haaretz kind of stuff. And so the mantra of the Israeli officials is, if I can quote it, no prosperity, no development, but no humanitarian crisis. So it's to keep people right on the edge of starvation. And so these aid shipments that come from various places throughout the world need to conform extremely strictly to these guidelines. And if they don't, then they don't pass. And so that's really what's led to this situation, is that the meticulous detail of which the blockade has been administered makes it so that it's almost impossible. It really is almost impossible, as I'm sure George Galloway will tell you in the coming days. It's virtually impossible to get into the Gaza Strip with any kind of humanitarian aid. I mean, you don't need George Galloway. You can get the World Food Program or the United Nations to, or the International Committee of the Red Cross to tell you the exact same thing. And this is well known. I mean, it's not, these are not secret documents that are being dredged up here. This is, you know, what I'm quoting from is from government sources. It's from openly in the newspaper, and it's well known within the Gaza Strip. I mean, since the war the assault on Gaza in December and January, there has been literally not 1 ounce of concrete allowed into the Gaza Strip to rebuild. I mean, you cited that police station. They're still moving out the rubble, but they're not moving any kind of rebuilding products back in. No glass, no wood, no beams. None of the fundamental, no metal, no metal reinforcements for, to build with concrete at all. You know, the United Nations actually reconstituted, absurdly enough, reconstituted the demolished section of the wall when Hamas blew up the wall in the winter of 2008 and allowed people out of Gaza for the first time sometimes in 15 years. The United Nations actually used that concrete section of the wall, because Israel rebuilt the wall, Egypt rebuilt the wall on Israel's request just a few meters away from where Hamas blew it up. The United Nations took that concrete, reground it up, and made it into a water filtration plant, because there's been no rebuilding in an area that was devastated as totally as, as Flashpoint listeners, I'm sure, are well aware of the totality of the destruction in the Gaza Strip during that attack. Nothing has been rebuilt. You know, you have situations where people are building with mud. And so it's just the question is what you want to look at to find how the blockade has affected people. And so I happen to be in Arish, and so I go and look at the rotting food. But if you were in southern Israel around Sedero, you'd go up and you'd probably meet with the Israeli farmers who themselves are upset about the blockade, because it's meant that their foodstuffs can't be sold to the captive market in Gaza. And remember, you have a 1.5 million people in Gaza. You have three Tel Avivs worth of people that are a captive market for Israeli products, and that's no small thing for Israeli farmers. So, if you want to ask health professionals the impact, you get one set of stories. If you want to ask machinery people who work in the machinery and sections of the economy, agriculture, and so I'm just in a situation where I can see the rotting food, but if I were, in a different place, I would explain a different element of this siege, which is total, and that's what's important to understand. This is not a defense against rocket fire or, a way to make it so that, one prisoner of war, Israeli prisoner of war, is handed back. you have an absolute war on a population that takes place in their ability to eat, to live day by day. And in fact, you know, like I said about the humanitarian element, the health element, you have people that lose their limbs unnecessarily simply because they can't get the basic medications that the rest of the world takes for granted, something like insulin, you know. And so it's just which area you decide to, you know, focus your lens on to see the totality of the blockade.
And speaking of focusing your lens, John Elmer, you're an accomplished photojournalist. And if you get into Gaza over the next few days, what do you hope to be reporting on, documenting? What are your stories that you hope to cover?
Well, I mean, I've reported a couple times for Flashpoints from Gaza over the last 5 or 8 years. And I am curious to see a situation where, you know, in 2003, I was, my interviews, my photographs, my discussions with people were talking about how 2003 was the worst year people had ever seen. You know, then 2005, the siege really cracked down after the disengagement, and people said, you know, we've never seen a worse day. And then I was there in 2006, 2007, when the American and Canadian-backed attempt to overthrow the Hamas government militarily, which is one of the reasons why this humanitarian catastrophe has been inflicted, is because the military attempt to overthrow Hamas failed. You know, I was there, people said this is, you know, the worst day we've ever seen, you know, since the catastrophe in 1948. We've never seen anything like this. You know, this Gaza Strip is a refugee population. It's effectively, I mean, it's a ghetto, it's an open-air prison, these kind of phrases, but it's effectively a refugee camp. And what you have is Palestinian farmers who lived on, you know, on Fulham farms in what is now Israel, and were driven into these squalid refugee camps where they live, you know, with population densities that rival Manhattan. You know, in what are refugee camps where people are, you know, 88% dependent on food aid. So from that main narrative is being now added this really unprecedented war attack on the civilian infrastructure in Gaza, openly on the civilian infrastructure in Gaza. I mean, you mentioned the police station. It wasn't Hamas militants. It wasn't you know, Hamas militant cells that were the attacks, that bore the brunt of the attack of Israel's assault in December and January. It was civilian police officers, that the Americans and Canadians are funding in the West Bank as a key strategy to, quote, you know, to make the two-state solution possible. In Gaza, it was those civilian police officers that bore the brunt of the attack. The first bombs dropped midday, midweek, at a graduation ceremony for civilian police officers. These are traffic cops. I mean, guys that stood out in the middle of the road and made people in a land without stoplights, as people are familiar with the region know all too well. You know, traffic officers, that was the target of Israel's first significant statement. You know, their shock and awe statement was the target of this civilian infrastructure. So although every time I've returned to this region, the situation has gotten worse, you know, it's hard for me to imagine what I'm going to face after, you know, in 2003 when I went there, I was shocked at the level of destruction in 2003. And that seems like, you know, a glory day ago for the way people are living today.
All right. Well, we'll be following your travels and work, of course, in and out of Gaza and Egypt again with us on Flashpoints. We're so glad that you're going to be there on the ground. And John, please be safe. We'll check back with you later this week. And people can check out your website at www.johnelmer.ca. That's spelled J-O-N-E-L-M-E-R.ca. John, thanks for being with us today on Flashpoints.
Thanks for having me.
In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We return to the Gaza Strip with Barbara Lubin of the Middle East Children's Alliance. She has also returned to the Gaza Strip. Now inside, I believe, is Cynthia McKinney as well. And I believe the supply aid caravan by the British parliamentarian has also made it in, George Galloway. Barbara, welcome back to Flashpoints. What's going on the ground? And is this mean that there's finally supplies getting through?
Cynthia McKinney is with the group, and George Galloway came to Gaza, but he just came in for a short time, and he went back to Great Britain. But, you know, the real story is not how much aid got in, what got in or didn't get in. The real story is the fact that there are an enormous number of young Arab Americans on this trip, and they've been fabulous, and they're the future leaders. And for me, that's been great, because in all these 21 years I've been working in Palestine, it's always been older people that have done the work. But now there seems to be a whole new generation of young men and women. There's these great guys from New Jersey, from all over the place. And it was very exciting to see the reaction of the Arab Americans when they finally got into Gaza. And it was very difficult getting there and getting in. And we were only allowed to stay for 24 hours. And we're still in Gaza. We're at the checkpoint, but we're on our way out. We were told that the Egyptian government put this time limit on how long we could stay in Gaza. So we were in, and now we're out a little less than 24 hours later. But to see the reaction of the Palestinian American community, many of whom hadn't seen their families in Gaza for many, many years, when they got off the buses, when we were finally got in and they all got on the ground and started kissing the ground, it was really, and crying and chanting. It was very moving. And that, for me, was one of the best things that I've seen in terms of this whole delegation.
So there were relatives waiting to greet them, or had they made arrangements? Tell us a little bit about that.
When we got off the buses, there were many, 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 many Palestinians on the Gaza side that had come to see their relatives, to greet them, and to greet the whole caravan, the whole convoy. And, you know, there was a lot of celebrating, and it was very moving. You know, I'm not used to seeing that kind of thing, because I'm used to coming in by myself or with one or two other people quietly. But there was all this chanting by the people that came on the caravan, and then there was responding chanting coming from the Palestinians on the ground in Gaza. And it was very moving. It was really great. And many people came and had expectations of being able to spend much more time with their families, and were very disappointed to learn that they could only be with them for 24 hours. And I'm not sure yet, but I have a feeling that some people stayed.
You're not sure yet, huh? You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. That's Barbara Lubin. One thing we're sure of is she's been focused on the illegal occupation of Palestine for some time, and trying with the Middle East Children's Alliance to mitigate, to bridge some gaps. This is an amazing, this is a very different kind of bridge, Barbara, than building a daycare center for the disabled, or for building a clinic. This is sort of rebuilding the spirit.
Yeah, I think that this brought a lot of happiness and excitement to the Palestinian community in Gaza. It made them see that there were hundreds of Americans with American flags and on these buses with all kinds of banners on it, support of the Palestinian community. They were really happy, and it was uplifting for them. And it worked the same way for the people on the buses. It's a very different, you know, there's all different ways that people need to work in America and around the world. And one of them is to go in and break the siege in whatever way they can. And then there are people like Mecca who go in and do the political work, but also do the political work in a very different way. And Dennis, what was great for me was being with Dr. Mona Alfaro for 24 hours and being able to go and see all of our projects, all the MECA projects, and to go and see our water projects in these schools. So far, we've done 3 of them. And, of course, there are over 230 other schools waiting for us to do it. So we have to raise the money for it. But to be able to drink pure water in the worst of situations was very exciting. Excuse me. There's a lot of dust here. And to go and to our daycare centers and to go to our mental health project.
Let me ask you, Barbara, what were the things that were most on Dr. Mona's mind? What did she want you to know, and what were the things that were of paramount importance to her at this point?
Well, you know, she had been out of Gaza for over 5 months, and this was an opportunity. She went in right before the convoy, like just a day or two before. She didn't think, she had no way of getting back in, and she finally did get in. So for her, it was a homecoming to her home and her country and her apartment. And all of her friends were coming, bringing her food and welcoming her. And I'll tell you, Dennis, it was unbelievable. Having been here in January, you know, being in Gaza towards the end of the war, and to be in Cairo for 2 weeks before that, organizing the MECA aid, which was like $1.6 million, including our ambulance, and to come back here, what is it, 4 months later, and to see that the Palestinians are incredible people. With all the horror that went on, life has gone back to some sort of normalcy for most people. Of course, there are the people who are unable to rebuild their homes, and people are looking at ways of using mud to rebuild homes because the Israelis will not allow any cement to come into Gaza for them to rebuild. So you have this huge population, 5,000 people whose homes were completely destroyed, and 20,000 people whose homes were partially destroyed and are unable to live in, who are without housing. And today we met with these little children who were telling, one child told us that her mother had been killed, 3 of her siblings had been killed. One after another of the kids was telling us these horror stories. But if you came in now, it's so different than it was in February, January and February. You know, there is some normalcy that's going on here, but there's still a lot of horror.
And
but it was very different.
And finally, yeah. Barbara, we just have a few seconds, but you've alluded to this. You've mentioned this twice now, that the Egyptians made sure you only had 24 hours. So I guess
yes.
They are still in a collaboration with the Israelis to make it incredibly difficult for this normalcy to be supported with the...
You know, Dennis, you are absolutely right. And I've been trying to tell people on the convoy this, but, you know, everybody's talking about... you know, blaming everything on the Egyptians without the larger view that it is, in fact, Israel and the United States who tell the Egyptians what to do. I'm not letting the Egyptians off the hook, but you can never forget the wider picture, and that's a picture of occupation and the picture of U.S. imperialism. So, yes, I agree with you.
All right. Barbara Lubin speaking to us from the checkpoint at Gaza between the occupied Palestine and Egypt. Again, trying to do the good work of alleviating the suffering and building a bridge, getting the information out, and bringing some hope to an incredibly difficult and many times lethal situation. Barbara Lubin of the Middle East Children's Alliance. Again, thank you very much.
Thank you, Dennis. Bye-bye.
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints, which airs every weekday and is produced by Dennis Bernstein and Nora Barrows Friedman. Our contributing producer is Robert Knight, and our technical director is Eric Klein. Our Friday co-host is Francisco Herrera, Miguel Molina is our roving producer, and JR and the Block Report contribute to this program. To comment on today's program, please contact us at dbernstein@igc.org. Look us up on the web at www.flashpoints.net for our archive shows. Dozens of affiliate stations across the country broadcast Flashpoints on a regular basis. Please email us your call letters and Flashpoints broadcast schedule at dbernstein@igc.org, and we'll add you to our website. Many thanks to our web team, and thank you for listening.